Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 144. This week, we talk with Keith Horwood about Standard Lib, Nodal, and NTSeq. Stack Overflow releases their 2017 developer survey results. .NET All the Things. And VS Code uses 13% CPU to render the blinking cursor.
This episode of the MS Dev Show is brought to you by Espose, the market leader of .NET and Java APIs for file business formats. Natively work with DocX, XSLX, PPT, PDF, MSG, MPP, image formats, and many more.
This week we have Keith Horwood, founder of Standard Lib and author of the API framework Nodal. How's it going, Keith?
Hey, not too bad. Happy to be here.
Perfect, perfect. And Carl, looks like you have some kind of gear update. What did you get?
Yeah, so we've talked at length about how, at home I have a standing desk, and I've got the Ergotron arms holding up my monitors. And well, it's really nice to have these Ergotron arms because, you know, I can move my monitors at will and they kind of just stay there. You know, one of the things I never was quite happy with is they never kind of got high enough for me. Yeah. So I was kind of like digging around on their web page, maybe seeing like, maybe I bought the wrong thing. And I noticed that if you have a single monitor, they have like this tall mount. However, they didn't have that for the dual arms. So I contacted their customer service line, and they had mentioned that they actually make these plates that extend the VESA mount on the back that hooks up to the arms. So it's just a steel plate with the holes cut in the right places, but it moves it either 4 or 6 inches up.
Okay.
So I bought these little plates, and we'll have a link in the show notes if this is something you want. But this moves the monitors up for me. I'm a pretty tall guy. I'm 6'2". So it moves them up, and now I'm absolutely loving my standing desk, you know, 2 to 3 times as much as I was before. It really makes a huge difference having my desk a little bit lower and my monitors much higher.
Okay, perfect. That's great.
So if you're in that situation too, just check out the show notes and check out the mounts. They're pretty cheap.
Okay, very cool. Well, yeah, I mean, if it's just a piece of metal with some holes that are in the correct locations, but I think it's pretty expensive too. Inexpensive, right?
Yeah, it was a little bit more than I wanted to pay. I think it was like $20.
Yeah, $20.
But
yeah, I mean, that seems about right. They got to make some money.
But it's worth it.
Yep, absolutely. And then I have a bit of a gear update. So if you heard me on previous episodes, I talked about how the AT&T iPhone 7 Plus was junk. The wireless chip in there, it was absolute junk. I finally took matters into my own hands and spent a ridiculous amount of money to replace my brand new phone with another brand new phone. But this time it's essentially the Verizon model, which has the Qualcomm chip. So I'm using the Verizon iPhone now with AT&T. No Bluetooth issues whatsoever. And supposedly this thing has like better 30% better LTE speeds. I think that Apple cranked that down though. They actually underclock the Qualcomm chip to make them even. But anyway, I have the good model now. So my oldest son has a ridiculously overpriced phone compared to his his peers. But it's a kind of a long story why I had to keep that other one. You know, AT&T basically gave it to me for free, but you know, they have me in their clutches at this point. So I had to drop a whole bunch of money. So now Apple's trying to pay me off because of all the hassle that I went through. So they're actually sending me a free $300 Bluetooth speaker because of how much hassle I had with this whole issue. So the moral of the story is, and I think this is what I've said on the show before, if you are getting an iPhone 7 Plus, buy the Qualcomm model, which is the A1660 or the A1661, and you will not have this issue. That phone is superior in every way and works with every carrier. If you buy the 1774 or the 1778, you are only locked into like AT&T and T-Mobile, and you have a horrible wireless chip, and they're all the same price. So, you know, the more you know. So I'm done talking about that issue because it's completely gone now.
It's about time, Jason.
Yeah. So what do we have for the comment of the week, Carl?
This week, the comment of the week gets a developer small business license for Espose Total for .NET, which includes all of the Espose .NET products in one package. And it goes out to John McBride on Twitter. He said, nice poster of what's new in VS 2017. Thanks to Jason Carl and Amanda Silver for the heads up. Mm-hmm. And this was in response to last week's episode when we talked about what's new in Visual Studio 2017. And we had Amanda Silver on. And that was a pretty fun episode, I think.
Yep. I'm trying to get my hands on some hard copies. I don't know.
Oh, that would be nice.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get some so that I can.
You should try to hit up the Visual Studios team, see what the if they have any. You would think they would.
Yeah, that's what I did. I might have to go invade their building and just look for them. they probably have a whole stack of them somewhere.
So if you want to get mentioned on the show like John, send us an email to feedback@msdevshow.com. Comment on Facebook, YouTube, or Stitcher. We really like those 5-star iTunes reviews.
Okay, so let's jump into the news. We got some really cool stories this week. So the first one here is enhanced open source license descriptions and metadata. You want to explain this one, Carl?
Yeah. So in the past, GitHub has been making it easier and easier for us to add license information to our GitHub repos. Mm-hmm. You know, if you start a new one, it recommends that that you enter a little UI that will enter a license file for you. Or if you just do like a license with no extension or license.md, it'll autofill, give you a few options for you to pick from. And what they do now is when you're viewing these licenses for other people, it gives you a very short but easy to read English description of what this license does and does not mean. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you go to our repo for our website, which we keep out there on GitHub open for everybody to see, you'll see that we have an MIT license, and it says a short and simple permissive license with conditions only requiring preservation of copyright and license notices. License work, modifications, and larger works may be distributed under different terms and without source. And then they got some color-coded options that just says one or two words that is commercial use, modification, distribution, private use, so on and so forth. But yeah, it makes it really clear what it does and does not give you at a glance. Mm-hmm. So if you're not sure when you're picking a license or you're looking at somebody's repo that you want to fork, this makes it a little bit easier for you to make that decision in a little more educated way.
Absolutely. I encourage you to get a license on your projects. And now there's no excuses. Now it's pretty easy to understand these things. More from GitHub. GitHub contribution mug. Are you going to get one of these, Carl?
I already did. So the big thing, that the reason why I got one, is it's identical to our MS Dev show mug, except for the picture on it.
Yeah.
It's the same size, just a different color, same style.
So if you like our mug and, you know, you don't want all of your mugs to say MS Dev show, you can order the GitHub mug, which is very cool. $14. Right, Carl?
Yes.
And is there but shipping if you soon? Get.
Yeah, there's some shipping too. Okay. But if you have a GitHub mug and you want one of ours, hit up Jason or I. We've got some.
Yeah. And if you work at Microsoft, just come over to my office. I got a whole bunch of them here.
Just raid his desk when he's not looking.
In the past, we've tried to like get them to people and get other swag to people, and it turns out I'm very unreliable. So it's better if you just show up here and then I can just give you stuff.
So I have a question about the GitHub mug, actually. So is this just a generic design that they have matching contributions? It's not personalized at all.
Correct. Yeah, so that was my question before the show.
It looks like your contribution line, but it is not yours. It's just the same for everybody, just so they can spell GitHub and the nice dark dots.
I think the logistics of customizing them would be too crazy, but that's what I thought it was initially. And I asked Carl about it, and then I was pretty bummed out as well, because it's just a generic design. Everybody's looks the same.
Mm-hmm. It still looks cool, but that would have been really neat if you could get your own. Because you guys have seen all the crazy stuff people have done, like the hacks they've done in their contribution history to spell things out.
And, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Well, then that could be bad too. but yeah, I mean, with all like the computer connected printers and that, you'd think that they could do it. So come on, GitHub, let's allow people to customize these. Or if they don't have any activity, then you can just buy the standard one. Makes it look like you did a whole bunch.
it's totally my last year of contributions here.
Yeah. Google App Engine adds .NET support, love .NET, as it races to be the PaaS of choice.
Yeah, so obviously Amazon and Azure are the number one and two clouds by a long shot. Mm-hmm. But Google is doing what it can to catch up, especially in the PaaS area. The one little caveat with it, as you read this article, is it's .NET Core only. So if you were looking to do like a .NET standard MVC application that you want to host it in the Google Cloud, you're out of luck. But if you are looking at doing something with .NET Core, Google could be another option for you. definitely gives a little bit more competitor in the cloud area.
Yeah, I do want to look at this. What I don't understand is, you know, kind of how they deploy it. Like, I figured it was .NET Core the second that I saw it. But how are they, you know, the nice thing about the Google Compute engine is that it's supposedly infinitely scalable, and they handle pretty much everything for you, which is great. But in a language like this, I'm not sure how, you know, like if you store something like a static variable, for example, I'm guessing like in the next request that might not be there, because obviously that would limit the scale. So I'm not sure how they manage state and do that type of thing, or if it's really just like you know, something like Azure Functions on steroids. Or like a standard lib that we're going to be talking about here in a little bit. So I'm kind of, it's the whole differentiation is becoming a little cloudy to me. So I need to, no pun intended. So I want to look at this and I want to see how they're doing that. And then at first I thought maybe they were just running like, their Kubernetes platform and they were just running a whole bunch of containers. But then I found some pages that were talking about like, you know, Compute Engine versus Kubernetes. So this is a homework item for me to figure out what the difference is in the architecture and how they're pulling this off and what the limitations are is really what it comes down to. But, you know, I'm super happy that they're adding .NET support. And I think that's the power of .NET Core, right? It runs anywhere. So now we're seeing it run everywhere. Any other comments on that?
Regarding like Google Compute Engine, they also have Google Cloud Functions, which I think a couple of weeks ago they just announced is officially in public beta, I believe. Figuring out the delineation there of like Compute Engine versus Google Cloud Functions and how they're really going to differentiate those is going to be interesting to see moving forward. So.
Yeah, and then also versus containers, right?
Yeah,
because I watched their little video and like their Visual Studio experience, and it kind of looks like they're spitting out a container and then you put it up there. But if it's just containers, then why wouldn't I use Kubernetes? I don't know. I'm there's too many options now. They're all kind of blurring together, and maybe that is the point: is that they're all like super similar, and there's not a major difference in how we're achieving the scale now.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything in terms of developer experience anyway, I mean, you're going to hear about different technology stacks in the back end, but at the end, it's all just going to be provisioned containers, right? So the convergence is just all going to be around developer experience and actually getting, I mean, you're never going to have like a no ops workflow, but heading towards that dream of like, just like, I wrote my function or I wrote my software, it just works. I never need to think about this again. My job is done for the day and I'm not going to get a phone call on Saturday. Or a page on Saturday telling me everything's on fire.
Exactly.
So
we're in that noisy phase right now. You know, we're in the pain. We're in kind of the pain period where we can see what we're headed toward and we're just waiting for it. You know, this point where you can, you know, just open up like Visual Studio and then you say like, you know, run over here and you don't have to worry about scale and those other things. And you know, there's tricks to doing that. But I think we'll just kind of look back then at the previous era and be like, oh my god, that was such a hassle having to manage all these things. Managing is not fun.
It might take a while. I mean, I do think there is a certain hesitance or reluctance of, I mean, as software developers and as engineers, we like to have a really good understanding of how everything works, right? So like we can stack trace all of our errors. And so I think there is that sort of limited amount of like, well, we have to give up a little bit of control here. But I mean, just with the success of like Azure and AWS generally, I think people are in the industry are just a lot more comfortable, period, giving up that control. So I think piece by piece, we're going to end up giving up more and more of that control, but be okay with it.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Stack Overflow developer survey results 2017. So we talk about this every year because this is always super insightful. So what are you getting out of this, Carl?
The pieces that really kind of jumped out at me, they had a whole section on remote workers and how often people work remotely, job satisfaction on remote workers. So, you know, one of the things that I found kind of interesting is according to the survey, at least that they did, only 31% of developers never work remotely. That means the other 68.2% work remotely at least one day a month or more. And 11% of that is full time. And I think that's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. That's a lot higher than I would have guessed.
Yeah, there were some things in here that I wanted to. Oh, here we go. One of the things here too that I really liked was the most loved, dreaded, and wanted languages. This was pretty good. Mm-hmm. Loved. I'll just go like top three. Most loved: Rust, Smalltalk, and then TypeScript. TypeScript actually, you know, it made the top three, which is incredible. And it's funny because, yeah, whenever I find other TypeScript people, that it's always the same amount of love. So I can understand where that's coming from. The three most dreaded. I'll actually give you four. Yeah, oh man, this is dangerous. I'll give you four because the first two are really similar. Number one, Visual Basic 6. number two, VBA. And that's why I'm kind of counting those as sort of the same thing. Number three, CoffeeScript, which I can understand. It's funny, like, but people went to that because they liked it. But yeah, it's one of those things where I dread seeing it because it's just weird to me. Number four is VB.net. And actually pretty close up there, Objective-C is more dreaded than assembly.
Wow.
that's not where you want to be. And then most wanted, and I can actually, the number one is one that I actually want, which is Python. So we got Python, then JavaScript, then Go, and then C++. How did Java make that list? but Python is number one. Yeah. It's funny because Python's been around forever, and I remember seeing it. I'm like, okay, I don't need to learn that. I'll just wait 20 years and it'll go away. And like, it's stronger than ever. So I feel like it has staying power now. And I feel like I have to learn it because the array functions in there are absolutely awesome.
One other thing I thought was interesting. So they also had a loved, dreaded, and wanted list for frameworks, libraries, and other technologies.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And .NET Core was in each category.
Yeah. Oh, it was in what?
It was both loved, dreaded, and wanted.
Actually, so across the board, I won't go through all the lists where it was in there, but .NET Core made significant appearances in these lists. I mean, it's like infiltrated everything like overnight. It's pretty amazing. Top paying technologies by region. I'm sure everybody wants to know this. So I'm going to be US centric here, but in the US, number one is Go, then Scala, then Objective-C, then CoffeeScript. It's all the things that people don't like, except for Go and Scala, I suppose.
If you don't want to do it, we'll pay you to do it anyways.
Yeah. If you just want to hate yourself at the end of every day. What else do we have here? Let's see here. Correlated technologies is kind of obvious. Web developers tend to use JavaScript, SQL, C Sharp. Desktop developers use SQL, JavaScript, C Sharp. Oh, that's funny. It's just in a slightly different order. anything else? Popular programming languages, JavaScript, SQL, Java, C Sharp.
Well, the one thing I think is always kind of interesting is comparing this one. I forgot who does the other survey, but there's mm-hmm. that big survey that's done every month of most used languages. Right. And on that one, Java is like clearly heads and bounds ahead of everybody else by like several factors. But mm-hmm. here, Java and C Sharp are actually fairly close. Yep. So it's seeing that even though it's slightly ahead here and way ahead in the other one, that, you know, it depends upon which audiences you measure and how you measure them. Mm-hmm.
The other one's kind of cool here is years coding professionally. It seems to be this sort of aligns with Uncle Bob Martin, what he talks about. I mean, the distribution is definitely on the lower side. I mean, he was always saying that, you know, half, you know, the number of, I'm going to screw it up, but it's like the number of people coming into the industry is like equivalent to what's already in the industry. So you figure like half of the industry is like super inexperienced. and this actually backs that up. I mean, if you look at less than 7 years of experience, I mean, that seems to be like half of the distribution right there. So I think this data kind of backs up what he's saying. And if you get into, you know, like how many years I've been doing this, there's not many people. it gets really down. It's like single digit percentages at that point, which is kind of interesting.
So why do you think that is?
Well, so the way he explained it, I mean, it's just there's more people. So let's pretend like nobody else got into the industry. I mean, we'd see that whole demographic shift to be older over time, right? But what's happening is the number of people getting into the industry is actually increasing very quickly.
Yeah.
So it's not a bad thing. It's just that we have an influx of new developers, and they shift the curve down. The bars that would normally be big get shrunk down as you put this influx in the beginning where these developers only have, you know, 1 or 2 years of experience. There's tons of them coming in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, lots of brand new JavaScript developers too.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've been having my son learn, is JavaScript. And, you know, people are like, what? That's crazy. And it's like, no, like it runs everywhere. You can do anything with JavaScript. If you could only learn one language in your entire lifetime, programming language, a JavaScript is a decent option because you can build literally anything with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's cool too is because it literally just adopts paradigms from other programming languages as it sees fit, right?
It's like
it's almost like the comparison I make sometimes, and some people like kind of scoff at this, but the comparison I make is kind of like the English language.
Yeah.
The English language has so many like bring-alongs, whatever, from other languages of people just like, hey, this is now like an English word because I'm just going to use it all the time. Mm-hmm. JavaScript kind of does that with programming paradigms and concepts. And like people, I mean, there are people who only do like use functional programming paradigms in JavaScript. Yeah. And they're like, if you ever use the class syntax, like that is the new class syntax, like that, I don't even want that code anywhere near me. Then there are other people who are like, yeah, I just do all my object-oriented code is like written in JavaScript. So it's really cool that there are just all of these different opportunities and ways to write code with JavaScript. So
yeah, your technological uniqueness will be added to our own. I think that's all I wanted to call out in this. I mean, I actually was looking at this for like 20 minutes and I realized I was only about halfway through it. So there's a lot of data in here, but I find it extremely interesting. So anything else you want to call out, Carl? We should move on.
I think we should move on.
Okay. There's a new feature in Visual Studio Code. it uses 13% of your CPU when idle due to the blinking cursor rendering. So I guess, first of all, you know, I do work at Microsoft, so I'm gonna defend this because I have read what the cause is. So it's actually Chrome on Windows is the issue. There's a CSS property in the code that's making it like blink every 500 milliseconds. But for whatever reason, Chrome is like waking up that thread every 16 milliseconds, I guess. So it's like burning a whole bunch of CPU cycles. I guess if you have VS Code minimized, it doesn't happen. But while it's open, it's actually using quite a bit of CPU power to render the blinking cursor. I actually saw, did you guys see the dramatic video? Maybe I'll splice it. I'll put that like at the end of the show on the video version. But there was a guy who made a dramatic video showing this whenever he changes the cursor and what happens.
No, but there's a Reddit thread about this where somebody like even goes and figures out how many people use VS Code and how much extra energy this is wasting and how much extra carbon it puts in the atmosphere. Yeah. So there's somebody who took this a little bit too far. But, you know, it's just to, you know, one thing I'd like to remind people is, you know, VS Code is an Electron app. Electron apps in general have certain things that they bring and carry with them. Like you said, the Chromium rendering engine being one of them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when there are, it's nice because you get a lot of things for free, but you also bring along all that stuff and the bugs when you do find them.
Yeah, the YouTube video is 2 minutes long. I'll include it after the end of the show. But yeah, he's just showing like because there's six different cursor options in VS Code, and he's got over 7,000 views in the comments. I like the part where the cursor blinked. made me cry. Another, why is there always one dude that has to dislike the video? Anyway. Is that all we had for news
this week?
It looks like it. Okay, well let's get to talking to Keith, because that's really why we're here. And actually,
well,
this,
thank you.
Yeah, so this kind of comes full circle because you know, we were talking about different ways to, you know, just publish your code and not really think about what's going on there. So I think we should start by defining serverless architecture. And is there really no server? Or I think before the show you were talking about it taps into Elon Musk's brain or potentially the computer that's running the simulation that we're all part of. So are those myths or is that reality?
Yeah, well, the truth is the universe is a simulation and serverless code just like runs in the ether and it just now. Yeah. So, well, I mean, I think the way that's it's been best described to me, I mean, everybody just kind of jokes about this, is it just means it's like somebody else's cloud or somebody else's Kubernetes cluster is really where you're running code. I mean, serverless, yeah, the term is a misnomer. I've had discussions with people like we don't call cars horseless carriages.
Yeah.
So like, is the term serverless really going to stick around for the future? I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's caught on in the industry. Everybody uses it to refer to this type of architecture. I think function as a service just generally is how people are starting to like, okay. It's just on-demand functions. I mean, really, at the end of the day, it's just containers being spun up on demand to handle functional API requests. Mm-hmm. That's really all it comes down to. And like the technologies that are running behind the scenes, whether it's like Azure Functions, Google Cloud Functions, or AWS Lambda. Now, I don't work on any of these teams directly, but yeah, as far as my understanding, it's the same basic idea of like lean containers that run Node or run Python or what have you that are just provisioned kind of at will. So the gain of serverless is just that like you can trust these big companies to basically handle this automatic provisioning for you. And so you don't have to worry about scale. It changes the way that you have to think about building applications, especially in something like Node.js. Because when Node came out, when Node first came out, I mean, the big win for Node was like the non-blocking asynchronous IO. And it's like, okay, cool. Now we can have one HTTP server just running a Node instance that can handle, I mean, 10,000 concurrent HTTP requests like simultaneously, right? So the paradigm of serverless kind of changes that because now the state that you might have been saving in your single Node.js instance that could scale like at least vertically for one instance, you don't maintain state anymore. So you can't, you still got to kind of think about caching because there's a chance the same container could be hit two requests in a row. So you can still do things like caching, but it just requires a different approach. I am actually kind of a huge fan of it because it comes back to like the whole point of like RESTful endpoints and resources to begin with. Like HTTP is a stateless protocol. So when we started getting into all this like real-time web and WebSocket stuff, we got away, like we almost started to, and like Node.js, we almost started to forget that this is all supposed to be a stateless protocol and very simple. So it's kind of bringing us back around, right? I mean, it's at the end of the day, I mean, I've heard this comparison made, right? I mean, a few years, it wasn't even that long ago. It was like a few years ago, we were dragging and dropping PHP scripts into FTP.
Yeah.
And like then it's like, oh, your script just runs. I mean, that's really all that's, we're going back to those days, except instead of a PHP script, it's like essentially dragging and dropping a JavaScript file. And it's like, oh yeah, your function just runs when it's hit. And everybody's like, wow, this is so, and it is, it's amazing because we got so complex for this really short amount of time. And we're going back to that simplicity of like, really, oh, I could just upload a PHP script and it works, right?
So that's my number one question that I always get on Azure Functions is like, does this store state for me? No, you have to externalize that. That was kind of interesting that you said that sometimes you will, like if you were to save it in memory, for example, sometimes you could access it. I've never seen that before. I guess my rule though is, you know, definitely don't count on that, right?
Oh yeah, don't count on it at all.
Yeah.
So the platform that I've worked the most in depth with, and that we built our core technology on to begin with, was on AWS Lambda. Mm-hmm. And so AWS Lambda is a complete, like, I mean, I'll just be honest, it's a black box. Nothing about how the actual system works. And I mean, for good reason, it's their IP, right? But nothing about like how the system is actually working behind the scenes is documented.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to intuit a lot of stuff and just kind of figure out how it's all working by trial and error. But yeah, at the end of the day, you can actually share state between requests as long, at least with Lambda, as long as it's very, you have been able to in the past, as long as it's a very quick turnaround.
That's interesting.
Between requests. The same container could be used.
Yeah, I wonder if that works on Azure. So the Azure Functions, by the way, are quite a bit less of a black box because it uses the like the Kudu deployment engine, which is all open source. I think a lot of pieces of Azure Functions is actually open source. There is some black box-ish stuff that kind of wires everything together and does the scale. We might have to have another Azure Functions episode, but I think a lot of pieces of that are very well known. But I always just think of it as like there's a giant supercomputer there running, and I'm just telling it how to handle specific things, you know, like you said, stateless web requests, and I, that's what I work with, and then you handle everything else for me.
Yeah. Yeah, what's interesting about the way that some of these providers handle requests, though, is what I think the opportunity, anyway, around serverless technology, really like function as a service technology, is really heading towards the path of being able to establish like a really solid, because we've gone from like SOAP and then everyone like hated SOAP. And then we went to REST and it's like, okay, this actually makes a lot more sense. But I think there's actually the opportunity to start standardizing the way that we actually think about making these like functional, I mean, they're just remote procedure calls, right? Mm-hmm. So like making these functional requests over HTTP and even ways to consider like just in the future, I'm not pitching anything now, but just in the future, thinking about like different stateless protocols that can use less overhead than HTTP that can just be for like functional requests and things like that. I mean, I think there's like a lot of opportunity in this space that a lot of people are like thinking around, but we haven't quite got there yet. I still think there needs to be some sort of, even in the fact that you can write these functions in different languages like Python, Node, et cetera. In Node, you have like a very specific, or some providers give you access to a very specific like request and response object, right, that is actually from like the Node HTTP module. But you don't have that in like every language. And then Node has asynchronicity.
Yeah, and it's different on every language, yeah.
Yeah, so there's like there's still no like standard API and like how to think about like how you're writing these functions. So I think that's going to I think there's going to be a lot of innovation in that space in the coming years, and it's just going to get easier for developers overall.
That's interesting. I was actually going to ask you about that, cuz I do see that. It's like I look at the Lambda syntax for creating a function. I look at the Azure Functions one and then standard lib, and it's like, they're all sort of similar, you know, but I would have to tweak some things, you know, here and there. So.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm happy to talk kind of about what we're doing with standard lib in that regard.
Yeah,
you just mentioned there's like different syntax. So, I mean, the idea when we launched standard lib to begin with, I mean, the goal is we're obviously standard lib SCDLIB is just a reference to like the C standard library, right? It's just an homage for like a new generation of web developers. Standardlib.com. Well, like we were talking about the eternal spring of new developers.
Yeah,
that are like coming that. In. Yeah, right. So yeah, I mean, it's an homage, but I mean, the initial vision was really this serverless space, the microservices, the functions of service space. It's really confusing to get started in development with. At the end of the day, developers, I mean, we do. We spend a lot of time like learning new tools, learning Kubernetes, whatever. But at the end of the day, the reason that most of us got into development is to accomplish a very specific task. And like what you'll see in development over and over and over again is like, here's the goal you want to get to. I'm going to start. And then you have all of this research and like knowledge acquisition period. And then by the time you actually get ready to actually like build the thing you want to set out, you've ended up like building a framework or like something else just to get there. Right.
Yep.
So yes, more than I like to. I mean, that's probably the reason standard lib even exists in the first place, right? Is trying to build an app and then wrangling serverless technology around. Yeah, so I mean, the opportunity that we kind of saw was how kind of disjointed this whole space is. And I mean, people will say, oh, hey, like, don't use microservices for everything. It's like, no, what you want to do is build with a monolith to begin with, because you'll have like a framework, like you're going to build with Ruby on Rails or like shout out to my framework Nodal or whatever, right? But like, you're just going to start with something. It's like, this is going to get our app delivered in the shortest amount of time possible. And then once you have specific endpoints that are taking up like a high amount of compute, et cetera, you start offloading these into microservices, and then you can slowly adopt like a microservice architecture as you grow and scale your application. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. But the questions that we were asking is like, one, well, how do you manage all of those microservices? Two, can we reduce duplication of effort like across, like within an organization for transparency around their the microservices they've already built, et cetera? And three, like, does that have to be the way that people build? Like, are microservices so scary, or is like the tooling and the organization layer just not enough in the like serverless and microservice space to have people comfortable? So we kind of chose this abstraction layer of not the individual function, mm-hmm. but a group of functions, like a namespace, essentially. We just call them services, but like a namespace of functions, okay. Which would be a service. And each one of those has like a functional endpoint. Which is just like exporting a JavaScript function or whatever. So you kind of get this neat little mix between like, we handle HTTP routing and all that stuff. We have a gateway layer. So what you get is this like neat little mix of that, the granularity of the function, but still organized in such a way that it's familiar to what a lot of people would experience with like building like a traditional monolith. And so I think that's, we're trying to standardize around that. And also, we're trying to standardize across languages. So right now, you can only build functions for standard lib. I mean, as a function as a service platform, you can only build the functions with Node.js, with JavaScript. But the languages that you can access these functions from, we've actually built in SDKs in on Ruby Gems, mm-hmm. On the Python Package Index, and on NPM, just the lib package, LIB, that is a standardized interface across like all three languages, essentially, that allows you to interface with any function on standard lib. So if you go tomorrow, you write a neat service that does something cool. Maybe you don't publish it like publicly, but yeah. You just want to use different applications. You don't even have to remember like the HTTP endpoints. You don't have to do whatever. You just require the lib package. You can do it in any language you want, like, well, at least Python, Ruby, and Node right yeah. now. And then you could just do like, so for me, I have a DNA sequence alignment service that I use for demos and stuff, right? So in any Node app, anywhere, I can just use the lib package to do lib.keith.sequence. And it's going to call my service from standard lib and this whole dependency. And so we have this neat service composition story as well, right? Yeah. Because you can also use this lib package within a standard lib service, call out to other standard lib services, et cetera.
Man, I never, you know, it's funny, I've never thought of that, you know, because I always imagine this future where we, for whatever problem we're trying to solve right now, we use the language that makes sense, you know? So like Python is great for like arrays and like data management. And this is great because I could write, I mean, it sounds like what I could do, and the support might not be fully there, but I'm just picturing this future now where I have one function that's written in JavaScript because I'm processing some JSON that's coming off the wire. And then I'm calling something over in C# that I want to have some great, like, really structured code around, and I want to run some unit tests on that and have that full experience. And then I take that structured data and maybe I pass that over to Python in a dynamic format, and then Python does like its array stuff to it. I mean, having that sort of that invisible transport that lets me go between these sort of gives me that future, doesn't it? Where I can mix and match those languages.
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually what we're the most excited about, is really this just like composition and like community aspect,
awesome.
Right? So I mean, everyone right now is still writing their functions in JavaScript. We're going to be adding more language support,
yeah.
But because we have the SDKs in like Ruby, Python, and Node, as we grow out our offering, it's really just going to be like somebody wrote a Ruby function, but it's wrote a function in Ruby, but it's available on standard lib, and I can use it from any language I want. Right. And it doesn't matter. I don't have to like learn the language. I don't have to like install some special
SDK.
That's
pretty cool. That's pretty
yeah.
cool.
Yeah. So the service composition story is definitely something we're like really excited yeah. about, as opposed to just like, I mean, yeah, I can sit here and say like, yes, our deployment is super easy. We have tools like essentially we have our own command line equivalent. I mean, it's not Git. It's not source control. But we have a command line tool, lib. You can just type like lib updev. And it's going to deploy your function as a service, only takes like a second. So I can say like, yeah, this is really easy to use and whatnot. But what's really cool is the opportunities that this is going to open up in the future in terms of web development.
So instead of pulling in that ltrim npm package, I can now pass it to a function that will trim it for me.
Yeah, I think leftpad. I think
or leftpad, that was it, yeah.
Back when we first launched the newest version of the platform, I think yeah. in like October, one of the first functions that somebody created was like a leftpad function.
I'm just going to publish that. That'll be the new Azure. It'll be leftpad as a service.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So,
Espose offers a powerful set of file management APIs with which developers can create applications, which can create, open, edit, and save the majority of popular business file formats. Their product range supports a multitude of file formats, including Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, PDF documents, OneNote, Outlook, Project, Visio files, popular image formats, and many others. Espose produces APIs for .NET, Java, and the cloud, which can be utilized in almost any modern language available today. Visit www.espose.com for a free 30-day no-limitations trial And if you get stuck, message the friendly support team for help. All technical support is offered free of charge. Remember, if you're a lucky winner, you will receive a free developer small business license for Espose.Words for .NET, a powerful toolkit to work with Word documents in your applications.
So I was kind of curious then, hearing you talk about this. So how does this compare then? Is this like a competitor to the framework called Serverless?
I wouldn't say we're competitive with the Serverless framework. I mean, we have our own command line tooling.
So there's some overlap, basically.
There is overlap. Okay. As it's up to the Serverless team what they want to do. They're a very talented group of people. I mean, they're working with. They just announced their partnership with Microsoft and Azure Functions and whatnot. Mm-hmm. They can certainly plug in to what we're doing. So if you want your, I don't think they've announced any. I think they're focused on the big fish right now, like you guys over there, Microsoft. But I don't think there's any limitation on the integrations that can happen there. Like if you already use the Serverless framework, it's like write functions. We're just another provider, but we also have that, like the whole service composition story and library story. So if Serverless framework is like really what you're the most comfortable using right now, we haven't built an integration with the Serverless framework, but that's definitely entirely possible. Yeah. So I'd be hesitant to say we're competitive with them.
Okay.
We just have a different vision around. I mean, they're mostly focused on the deployment aspect, and we have a much different vision around like the future of. I mean, like I just said, service composition. Like we were just chatting about. So.
Yeah. Now I understand your comment now about trying to get rid of HTTP out of the mix, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you can do whatever protocol is like hyper efficient, to go from function to function. If you're able to use that, that starts to open up a whole new world of possibilities there. So if I'm using this library and something like that comes along, then I'm just sort of automatically enabled for that then, right?
Instead of
using like HTTP client or something like that, which is really tying me to that specific protocol.
Exactly. And so I think, yeah, and as we grow out this whole concept of service composition, I think those, I mean, yeah, that's why I brought up I think that might have been surprising at first, like, why do you want a different protocol? As you start growing out that service composition layer, this does become something that all of a sudden becomes, like, really enticing and exciting. So I don't know, nobody's really begun work on that yet, but it's definitely, like, a future, like, a potential future that our team kind of sees down the road. If anybody listening is kind of getting excited about this and like wants to reach out, I'm like happy to chat. My email inbox is always open, so maybe I can give it to you guys and you can put it on your website. So.
Yeah, I don't have any inside knowledge here, but I suspect like the Azure Functions team, they have to be thinking about this, right? If I just a shortcut for calling from function to function and then somehow deploying those together and improving that performance. I mean, that way I could chain together 10 different functions and really have it have the same performance as one. Instead of having to, you know, literally treating those things as separate units, and they could be running on different machines or whatever, but I'm sure that they got to be thinking about that kind of thing.
Oh, I mean, I think, yeah, I think all of the main function providers are kind of starting to think about this stuff, but it's going to be exciting. I think there's going to be a lot of innovation and development in a really short amount of time. So, like everything that you're seeing right now, there are buses here in San Francisco that have like the word serverless on the side, like where your serverless provided on the side of the buses, right?
Serverless so
it's
bus.
Obvious. It's obviously like the top of like the hype cycle right now. So I think we're still going to see a come down from that where people start feeling like, wait a second, this wasn't right for my use case or whatever. but eventually, like and probably faster than we expect, like we're going to get a whole ton of innovation in the space. Mm-hmm. So.
Any questions for you, Carl? I've been asking all of them.
No, I mean, but this is excited. A little bit more towards what you've been doing more recently anyways.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was going to bring up, you had mentioned that you had also worked on another project called Nodal, and we wanted to talk about that today too. So can you tell us what that is?
Sure. Nodal is a Rails-inspired API framework for Node.js. Basically there was, when the bifurcation, happened, between like Node and IOJS, seems like forever ago now, but it really wasn't that long ago.
And then the rejoin.
So there was the bifurcation, the rejoin. So the bifurcation happened and IOJS started supporting, all of the new, I mean, what does everyone call it now? Like ES 2016, ES 2017. At the time it was just ES6. Mm-hmm. So, IOJS supported all the ES6 class syntax. And I had been building so much stuff in Node for a while and had been super, like, really disappointed that there was no like Rails equivalents. Because I love just being able to spin up an application really quickly with Ruby on Rails. There were frameworks, but the problem is just without that abstraction layer. I mean, yes, it's only syntactic sugar, but without that abstraction layer around classes, it becomes really hard to create the kind of like, vernacular or like DSL that Rails has really created as a framework. And once we had that class syntax from IOJS, when the fork happened, I capitalized on that right away. And I was like, okay, I'm going to build out something like in the image of Rails for Node.js. It's going to be super easy. I ended up writing like my own ORM. Never write an ORM. I think they're like books. Never write one, but we got it. It works. It's great now. It has like, even has like GraphQL support and other cool stuff. But, and then the timing just ended up being really, really good. I made a bet on IOJS and like ES6 and like a merge eventually happening. And then the merge happened. And within, we already had like, we were using it in production at the company I was working at. I was the engineering lead at the time. We were using it in production. So it was getting testing. Like, we were just there at the right time. So I was able to like open source this stuff and release it maybe like a month, month and a half, maybe a little bit longer, but maybe like 2 months after the IOJS Node.js remerge. Mm-hmm. And I think when Node 4 really came out. And then we had like the first Rails, like truly like Rails inspired Rails like framework in Node.js. And it just kind of like took off like a rocket ship. It was January of 2016. It made the front page of Hacker News. Everybody got really excited about it. And that's what kind of set us off on, the journey with where we got to with standard lib. So we were just happy that people were building APIs using in this, because we approached this from the perspective of like your APIs should be stateless. I know Node can store state for you, but like forget about it. So that led really, really well into like the serverless ecosystem in terms of like one request, one response, stateless, don't worry about it. It kind of kickstarted the whole journey. So,
yeah, I see a lot of stuff in here. I mean, you got the ORM in there that you mentioned, schedulers, middleware, controllers, models, routing, tasks, authorization.
Yeah,
it looks pretty well rounded. I assume I can run this anywhere. I can run it locally. I could run it in a cloud provider of choice then.
Yeah. You can. When we initially built it, it was. I think it's set up to really easily deploy to Heroku, to be honest.
Yeah.
You can. But you can deploy it to literally any cloud provider. I mean, it's just a Node server. It's just like a Node daemon that runs in the background. So you can literally run it anywhere. We're going to be releasing like it, so Nodal's been in this interesting like pre-1.0, like happens to a lot of software, like pre-1.0 release. And I haven't been publicizing anything we've been doing with Nodal for probably like the last like 5 or 6 months.
Okay.
But it's still being like actively maintained and updated. Like we actually run a huge chunk of our like core APIs and infrastructure at standard lib. On Nodal. So, I mean, this is getting like heavy production use and testing.
Okay.
And there are tons of updates we've even made to the framework in the past, the past like 6 months that we have not written documentation about and haven't publicized just because we've been like really heads down trying to get like a whole small team, trying to get like a whole bunch of stuff done at once. But we'll be definitely preparing Nodal for like, I would imagine the 1.0 release will probably be within the next few months here.
Okay.
We're just the last support that we just recently added in like the newest release candidate is actually SQL transaction support. So you can actually like for Postgres, you can begin SQL transactions, run everything in order, and then roll them back if you need to. Because that was one thing, like one feature, like everybody asked for, and like we needed ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted like whenever you release open source, you want to make sure it's like the right abstraction layer, like it makes sense to developers, etc. So that's probably what the 1.0 release will be focused around is the support for SQL transactions. So
cool. Yeah, it looks very cool.
Yeah. So this next thing that I want to talk about, we don't have to spend too much time, but I was digging around on your GitHub page and you have a project that is pitched as a bioinformatics library that provides DNA sequence manipulation and analysis.
Oh, who doesn't?
So, yes. Tell us about that. 'Cause that just sounds pretty gosh darn interesting.
So, I mean, my academic background, I mean, I've been, it's funny, like, just to throw back to the earlier part of the conversation, when everyone says VB6, Visual Basic 6, is their, like, most dreaded language. I started programming in, like, Visual Basic 5 and Visual Basic 6. So,
well, that's why, like, everybody dreads it, because they know.
Yeah. So, like, I'm a self-taught developer. I actually went to school for biochemistry. So that's what I studied academically, like, all throughout college. And being like a JavaScript fanatic, a guy who's like really into Node and JavaScript, I wanted to do like a lot of, do bioinformatics work in Node.js. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of, I mean, there was a lot of stuff in Python, because I think that's like a scientific developer's language of choice. But there wasn't a whole lot of stuff in Node. So the point of NT-seq to begin with was just basic like DNA sequence manipulation of like, okay, I'm going to read a string of nucleotides, which is just like the letters ATGC. And then I can do things like, amino translation to amino acids. So like, what is the amino acid chain that this open reading frame, like just like the genetic code, like what actual proteins does it encode, mm-hmm. et cetera. So that's how the library started out. And then I had this problem in grad school where basically, I want to make sure I frame the problem correctly so I can explain why we, why I ended up building this. I essentially built an ungapped, sequence alignment, super fast ungapped sequence alignment algorithm that just uses bit operations to really quickly compare, two sets of sequence or like two sequences. Right. So we had this problem that I encountered, whereby there was a protein that I was looking for, or a protein that we had identified that bound, like it binded in DNA, it actually attached to DNA to a very specific, well, to a DNA sequence that was about 20 nucleotides, so 20 letters long. Now, this sequence, it didn't have to be, like, it didn't have a very high specificity, so it could bind to different versions of the sequence. And I wanted to very quickly go through an entire genome, like say the E. coli genome, I think it's, off the top of my head, I think it's six million base pairs. So I wanted to go through like the entire genome and say like, where could this protein possibly bind, knowing that like at position like 2, 3, like out of these 20 letters that it might bind to, it might only need like 14 of them. So this becomes like a combinatorics problem, right? Because you can pick like any 14 of these 20. So like the computation becomes massive there. So I really just wanted a library that could just instantly just compare two sets of sequences. And you can do this really easily by just translating the sequences into binary and just doing bit ands and like bit ors. Mm. So that's where, like, so I built an entire Node library. I actually originally did this in Go because I was like, this has got to be as fast as possible. Node.js actually outperformed Go. at doing like bare metal bit ops comparisons.
Yeah.
And like my justification, like looking at this, I was just like, what? but like my justification is that the V8 developers are much better at like optimizing my code in the just-in-time compiler than I am at writing highly optimized code in Go. So that would be my explanation. But yeah, it has Node.js performing at like bare metal speeds with bit ops, which is pretty great. And yeah, it's just for sequence comparison there. So you can say like, I'm looking for like ATGC in some chunk of like the human genome. Here are like all of the places it occurs. Here are all of the places where it matches three out of these four letters, et cetera. And we put that out, and like I actually get emails probably once every couple of weeks from bioinformatics students, like all over the world who are playing with it, and asking questions about like how to use the library. We actually just pushed out an update that I think broke some things for some people. So I've gotten a few more emails recently. But yeah, that's it's kind of like the whole story behind that.
Yeah, so. That sounds great. I understood some of those words.
Well, you know, one of my questions that I did have initially, and you kind of answered, is like, you know, could I swab my own cheek, you know, and get the results back and kind of, you know, do something with this? And I think, I mean, you answered it. You said you could compare an entire genome to...
Yeah, to a specific sequence, and it includes. It does sequence alignment, right? And so the whole concept of sequence alignment is just
so we have like known. There must be like known sequences then, and you're able to take, you know, like this is the sequence for, I don't know, feature X, and you're able to match that in the strand then.
Yeah. So this does, I mean, essentially, okay. So this does what's called, and so like anybody that actually has like a bioinformatics background is going to roll their eyes at this point because like what this library does is called ungapped sequence alignment.
Well, it sounds kind of like pattern matching, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is just pattern matching. Yeah. It's from that perspective, it's like relatively trivial. What's really interesting is gapped sequence alignment. So you start having penalties because like, I mean, DNA breaks that you have.
That's actually the biggest question I hear. Like it seems like it's a mess because it's not like there's parity bits, right?
Yeah.
Or like a checksum.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's what's really interesting. I mean, I'd love for developers to look at the library. I think with what we've built in terms of just like this, the raw speed, like the bare metal bit op speed. I mean, this was on Hacker News too, a couple of years ago when we first launched it, or when I first built it and launched it. But what's really interesting is just the speed of the ungapped alignment that we do. Mm-hmm. It's like literally theoretically the fastest that you can do this alignment because it's like bare metal, pure bit ops, literally takes, I think for like the map save check, whatever, takes like 7 processor cycles to store every result. So it's like literally theoretically as fast as you can possibly make it. So that combined with somebody who might be coming into the space and being like, well, I want a gapped alignment algorithm, but I want it to be really fast behind the scenes. I think there are opportunities there to like build and extend upon what we've built. It's just like I've never actually like published this in a journal or anything like that. And, it's free for anybody to look at the code and check out and play with if they want to. So
that's crazy. So what is your time breakdown with these three? I mean, you have like 3 projects that I'm sure you could work on full time. So is this like a third of your time spent on each of these things? I mean, what does that look like?
I mean, like NT-Seq as a library is like relatively mature. It's I update tests once in a while. Okay. Like something's an error. So that's not a whole lot of maintenance. Now, Nodal, we use in production full time. So, I mean, it's part of like what we're doing with the company. So, I mean, it's like half my whenever we need to update Nodal, it's like that's what happens. And with like standard lib, this is a like fully venture-backed endeavor. So, I mean, this is what we spend the majority of our time on. I have a lot of stuff on the go, obviously. I, like, rarely sleep. I actually do most of my coding I think my girlfriend kind of gets upset about it, but I do most of my coding between, like, probably, like, 10 p.m. And, like, 4 a.m., as, like, silly as that is, because, like, during the day, I'm just, like, dealing with, like, maintenance issues, like, talking to people.
I was going to say, then you don't have to worry about emails at those times either.
Oh, yeah, because, like, I mean, half the day, I mean, you guys know, like, half your day ends up getting taken up by just responding to people's emails.
I wish it was only half. I strive for half.
So, yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't, at this point in my career, I don't have, like, a whole lot of free time. But I honestly, I couldn't be happier doing what we're doing right now. And the amount of support we're getting from, like, the community, from other developers, from our early employees, like it's just been fantastic. And I feel just very fortunate to be able to be in this position. So
very cool. Yeah. I just feel like, we could sit down and like have a drink and talk about any of these projects quite a bit more. So, one question I did have going back to the first technology we talked about, the standard lib, it's built. So it looks like it's built on AWS Lambda. Is it tied to that at all? I mean, can I use it with Azure Functions?
Right now, you can't use it with Azure Functions. We are built Microsoft Dev Show. So we are talking about like, so what's most important to us really is the composition layer, right? At the end of the day, like the whole point of serverless is like, it shouldn't really matter where, and I mean, I think what we're going to see, I'm going to make this prediction. I mean, I think what we're going to see in this space generally is the margins on being able to charge for compute and stuff are going to rapidly approach zero.
Yeah.
So can you build a business? Like, is it valuable to just have a business built around like, hey, we do compute. No, you're not really ever going to be able to compete with Azure or AWS or Google Cloud. So that's not really, like, we're more focused around the organizational and like maintainability layer, than just like we're a compute offering. So we might have options in the future to be able to like, oh, plug into your AWS Lambda account, plug into your Azure account, plug into your Google Cloud Functions account. It's just not something we're focused on right now. What I'm really focused on anyway, at the end of the day, we just pushed out some material with Slack actually about how easy it is to like build a serverless Slack bot on our platform. It takes 9 minutes and you have a Slack bot and it's just working. Yeah. Like what I'm more focused on is not like oh my God, like how, what's this new model of compute look like or whatever. At the end of the day, what I'm focused on is building, like developers building things and like getting real results and like being able to use these tools to build something valuable, not just like a theoretical talk about like, what does function as a service mean in general. Mm-hmm. I want to deliver results for people. So, I mean, that's kind of what we're focused on.
Very cool. Very cool. Carl, do you have other questions?
Nope. I'm good.
Yeah, so I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to mention on any of these. I mean, we probably could have had a show on each of them, but I don't know if there was anything that we kind of went over too quickly that you wanted to dive into more, or you think that was a good high level, Keith.
Yeah, I mean, I'm super happy to chat more about any of this stuff, like really at any time, even for like if any of your listeners are like, hey, I'm kind of interested in this, and I didn't really. It kind of went really fast. I'm a fast talker too, so it kind of went fast. And I'd like to learn more about this.
I mean, that combats these people that speed up the podcast. just like the mess with them.
Yes. Oh, I totally did it intentionally. Yeah. So, I mean, if anybody wants to chat about any more of this stuff, or if any of your listeners want to reach out directly, I mean, I think we covered. I'm happy.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it was a great intro to all these technologies. I mean, I'm excited about them. In particular, this standard lib, I really want to look into this, because I'm pretty excited about the, the future of, I was about to say serverless, but we'll say, was it functional?
I like functions as a service. I really like
functions
that
as a service.
Yep.
Okay. Functions as a service. FaaS.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated by FaaS. So
you're really fascinated.
Fascinated. Exactly. Exactly. You got it. Okay. Very cool. Carl, what do we have for the app of the week?
App of the week is a really cool one. If you're working with IoT Hub, mm-hmm. Microsoft has on GitHub, an application called Device Explorer, and it lets you, configure your IoT Hub, create devices, manage them, add keys, revoke keys, remove devices. It's pretty much does everything you need in that area. So I highly recommend it if that's what you're working with.
So it's basically a test client for the IoT Hub SDK.
Yeah. And if you look at any of the Azure documentation, they around IoT hubs, they all point back to this Device Explorer, which is why it's also my dev tip of the week. It's on GitHub. Go look at this code. I mean, it's a great starting point if you need to make your own service, especially if you want to manage your own keys in a more automated fashion. I recently had to do this, and I looked straight at that code, and it's pretty easy to repurpose.
Oh, that's a good point. I thought that was a mistake that you had it in there for both.
Picks, no, so. It's not a mistake. I mean, you know, it's looking at these resources that Microsoft puts out there isn't just for us to use them straight out without thinking.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us are going to need tools like this going forward, but it's not going to fit our exact scenario. So let's just take that code. It's out there. It's open source. It's MIT licensed, and make it your own. You know, add the functionality you need to make it. Really make your product shine.
Okay, very cool. So Keith, we play a game on this show. What I need you to do is pick a number between 1 and 4 inclusive, and let me know what the number is.
Okay, but I got to tell you the number.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go with 4.
4. Okay. I'm sorry in advance. this is a kids game.
Yes.
And some of these questions are really bad.
Okay.
Okay. Would you? I'm almost inclined to pick a different one. All right, would you rather eat a handful of human boogers, or drink a cup of monkey spit? this is like the worst question we've had.
A handful of human boogers was the first one,
or monkey spit.
And I don't know.
I'm sure as a child I ate more than a handful of my own boogers. So
it doesn't say your own though. I mean, this could be like one from like multiple people.
All right. Well, I mean, I'll put some faith in my immune system either way, but maybe go with one. Maybe go with the boogers.
Okay. That'd probably take long. I don't know. Okay. That's a retired question that will never be spoken again. Okay, Carl, pick a number.
I'll take number three.
Keith's never coming back. Would you rather see this is the kind of question that we normally have. Would you rather have it rain caterpillars for one day or have it rain feathers every day for a month?
Feathers every day for a month. I mean, if it's raining caterpillars, you're going to step on them.
Sure. But if it's one day, I mean, like, I don't know, you just stay inside and then the caterpillars sort of go
away.
Yeah,
but they're going to like accumulate,
but they turn into butterflies.
I'm going with feathers.
Well, I'm going with caterpillars. I think you're wrong on this one. Because they're going to be around. The feathers are going to stay there for months. I mean, we're talking like probably a foot of feathers. I mean, they take up a lot of room.
They're going to blow away just like the snow.
Yeah. Keith's video just disappeared. I don't know if he's still there.
Yeah, he was sick of this questioning.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not putting up this. Are you still there, Keith?
All right, let's finish without him.
Okay. Well, you can find him. Let's see, where can you find him? He's on Twitter at Keith. So it's, let's see here. His Twitter is Keith, KEITHWHOR. So Keith Horwood. You can find him there. That's where I would go. Or at KEITHWHOR.com is where you can find him as well. Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Carl Schweitzer.
And you can find me at ytechie.com or at Twitter and twitter.com/ytechie. Keith, are you back? Okay, well, goodbye, Keith. It was super fun having you. Sorry that we made you leave.